Good morning. Well, on Tuesday it happened. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar went to the park, dissolved the Dáil, and an election is set for February the 8th. On the News at 1, Justin McCarthy conducted what is fondly referred to as a whip around, with whip being the operative word.
Are you proud of Fine Gael's record in dealing with the housing crisis with over 10,000 people homeless? But deal with the experience question then. How do you convince people that Fianna Fáil TDs are capable of running the economy, dealing with the trade negotiations that are coming up, given the lack of experience that you have in government? The problem is, though, Piers Doherty, if you want change, you're going to have to find a suitor, somebody who will go into government with you. And so far, nobody wants to do that. Your party has 7 seats. I think a recent poll put Labour at around 4%, I think, in a poll back around October. You have a lot of work to do, don't you, if you're going to build on that? Say to people who say that the Green Party are going to be bad for farmers, bad for rural Ireland, and are going to mean that people are going to have to pay more taxes to pay for their petrol and their home heating oil. Ruth Coppinger, smaller parties, I suppose, did very badly in the recent by-elections. How are you going to turn that around from Solidarity's point of view?
Tuesday's News at 1. Well, Ray Darcy both summed up the mood here in the radio building and raised a bemused eyebrow.
And they're off! They were out of the traps, weren't they? Out of the traps so quick. They were queuing up to get on with Sean O'Rourke and Justin McCarthy on the News at 1. Yeah, they've been chomping at the bit for this for a long time. There's a lot of pent-up canvassing in politicians all over the country. The wave of excitement that swept across the Open Plan office up in Radio 1 was palpable. I heard one person say, "This is my Cheltenham! This is my Cheltenham!" They were high-fiving each other, jumping up and down, doing star jumps. All very exciting.
But it is. Sean O'Rourke has been spotted skipping in the corridor. Mary Wilson's huddled in a corner, whittling up her 2B pencil to the sharpest of points. Cormac O'Hara, vocal warm-ups. And Katie Hannon's deep into constituency boundaries. And as for Morning Ireland, well, rumour has it they hit the early house. But the big news is also that the election is on a Saturday. Again, Ray Darcy, not impressed.
How many people did you hear since 11 o'clock this morning saying, "That's very interesting. Oh, that's very interesting. Very interesting. It's on a Saturday. Very interesting." How interesting is that?
Well, I think we let UCC's political scientist Dr. Teresa Reedy school you, Ray Darcy, in just how interesting that is.
It's an interesting choice. Over the last number of years, we had become quite accustomed to voting on Fridays, but many of our European neighbours actually do vote over the weekend, although most of them actually on Sundays. They vote on Saturdays in Australia and New Zealand, and there's clearly a rationale that's been set out by the Taoiseach for why he's decided to take this decision. But I suppose the most recent time we have used Saturday voting was actually on the children's rights referendum, and at that time, after the referendum, there was a lot of concern that the Saturday voting had actually led to a lower turnout than had been the case at many of the kind of other referendums we had at that time. So you have to hope that there will be some kind of promotion or information campaign for voters, alerting them to this change. And that's somewhere that we're actually pretty weak in Ireland. We're not very good at actually providing election information to voters. We're very good at doing it for referendums, but we actually don't do it terribly well for elections.
Yeah. But there has, I think, been a by-election in 2001, which took place on a Saturday, where the turnout wasn't too bad, I think, in around 55%, something along those lines.
Well, we might be zipping up the political anorak just a little bit there, in fairness. But of course, a Saturday vote might just facilitate a greater turnout among the student population. On Morning Ireland, Jill Steadman went out to Maynooth University and spoke to students to gauge the mood.
We see here in Ireland that student engagement is going up all the time. Especially here in Maynooth, we can see it bit by bit going up. And that means that we're starting to question. We're starting to question our higher education funding. We're starting to question why our mental health services aren't being funded. What are we doing to help with climate action? We are questioning everything, and our vote will be detrimental in the election.
Young people of Ireland have shown time and time again that they are aware of the issues, that they want to make an impact, and they know that this election especially is going to impact their future. You know, whether it's the climate crisis, whether it's issues with housing, like whether or not we're actually going to be able to afford rents or afford a place to live in the future. So on all these kind of different issues, students have shown that, especially on social issues, they're very clued in, they're very aware, and they want to shape the Ireland for the future.
Students from Maynooth University on Morning Ireland. And of course, politicians anxious to get that crucial youth vote will be focusing on social media. So, how is it determined what pops up on your Facebook? Who will you be following on Twitter? And those Insta stories, just what will it all mean? Well, on the Seán O'Rourke Show on Thursday, Susan Daly of Journal Media, Philip Ryan of Independent News and RTÉ's Niamh Lyons looked at how parties might push their policy manifestos in mediums that don't really lend themselves to long-form analysis or depth.
We'll see a lot of the manifesto stuff coming out in these little punchy bite-sized pieces with like videos, with music beds. And the way it was done in Britain was interesting. A lot of the time the word manifesto wasn't even used because that was seen as kind of being too linked to policy. So Jeremy Corbyn, for instance, did a sort of a back of a black cab thing where he, in 60 seconds, had to ream off as many of his own policies as he could remember. Boris Johnson followed that up with a similar video saying, well, here's our top seven policies. So again, really trying to feed into this idea that people have a minimal attention span.
If they say, for instance, that Twitter won't allow political ads, at the same time you get somebody like Vicky Phelan tweeting her support for Alan Kelly, the Labour TD and party health spokesperson. Now, that's if
last
you like getting our
John Delaney supported him, I think, did he?
Well,
but that's very well. John Delaney and Alan Kelly are both from Tipperary, so that, but it does show that there is some weight. We'll say. Say, for example, Twitter, right? And we don't have a huge proportion of the population on it. What we do have, though, is influencers who get a chance, and I'm talking about political and social media influencers, to repeat tweets like we're doing here on a wider reaching platform. And so what you're looking at is what takes off there. And what takes off there, which we saw with previous referendums, is actually to do with issues and personal stories. So if politicians can tap into that, then they'll be doing well. People do ignore the rather larger, you know, campaign pieces, because you're also sending those to people who follow you. The people who follow you are people who are probably already going to vote for you, so you're not exactly converting votes at that point.
The Seán O'Rourke Show on Thursday. But sneaky memes aside, you still won't be able to budge without seeing election posters. Politicians in their Sunday best, be it open-shirted, casual, out-and-about shots, up-close and airbrushed. Political posters will be festooning our roads and roundabouts. Seamus Maguire of posterfree.ie is not happy, citing single-use plastic and cable ties, which make them quite environmentally unfriendly. He spoke to Ray Darcy.
It looks like the days of the posters for elections are numbered.
Yeah, well, we definitely thought, we got huge traction at the locals, and we definitely thought that it was definitely coming to an end. Any survey that's done, Ray, over 90% of people say they don't want it.
Well, so, I'm looking here, a Clareburn Live poll got 77% of respondents said that they thought the use of posters during election campaigns should be banned.
Yeah, and so you're left with the question, well, who is it serving? Who are these posters serving? All you get is an image, maybe, and a party name on the top, but you're getting no information from this. If you really don't know who you're going to vote for, you're going to go on, you're going to search, you're going to do a bit of research. So, and most of these posters, ironically, when candidates say they're reusing posters, 5 years later, they look nothing like the image on the poster, I might say, for a lot of them.
Well, there can be quite the youthful glow, in fairness. Portraits rotting in the attic, perhaps. Of course, with elections comes jargon going forward. And all that. On Wednesday's Drive Time, Dr. Inés Bailey of the National Adult Literacy Agency spoke to Mary Wilson, and she wants politicians to use plain language and say what they mean. She has some linguistic bugbearers. First up, drive.
You know, you'll hear a lot about driving on or driving out or driving. Now, usually we think if you drive a car or you might drive out cattle, but I think in terms of drive, it's
drive change.
Exactly. And we kind of come away from those sentences and we go, well, what exactly is going to be different there? And why can't politicians just say exactly what they mean?
You could drive an agenda, couldn't you?
Yeah,
in
and
politics.
Then again, you're kind of going, what does that mean? What is the agenda? Usually agenda is a term that you use when you're going to a meeting and it's a piece of paper in front of you, so you see the agenda. But if we hear about politicians talking about an agenda, we're not quite sure what the agenda is.
And they could pledge to drive the agenda.
Indeed. And yet you're sort of saying, you know, is that a commitment or are they just going to do something?
Oh, she's not mincing her words. And there's more.
Tackling.
Yeah, I think that is really tackling something we think, of, we think of that as really something in the context of rugby or football.
Transforming.
Yeah, we've a lot of transformation going on in society and the economy.
We have transformation as the name on several documents probably as well.
Yeah, but actually what we want to know is what's going to change as a result.
Strengthening.
It sounds good.
Strengthening our back bench.
Yeah, indeed.
Our front bench.
But what does that actually mean? I think if they want to use the airtime that they have wisely, they need to really think about what is the message they want to leave the listener with. So they're either going to waste that time by filling it with a bit of hot air, or they're going to get a point across because that's what they really want the person to understand they're going to do.
And Mary Wilson wants to know this.
Are we dialoguing at the moment?
We probably are, and there's probably lots of phrases that, in fairness to politicians, we do tend to all use them, especially when we hear them in the media. But I think if your intended purpose as a politician is to get a message across about what you're actually going to do, you need to be aware that these terms and phrases are perhaps undermining your intent. And what people really want is plain speaking. And if you have a particular term or a jargon term, explain it to people and get straight to the point, because that's what is least frustrating, I think, for the listener.
This interview is now over. Inés Bailey.
And so is playback, for this part anyway. Welcome back. On Monday, it was batten down the hatches time as Storm Brendan hit Ireland. There were high winds, lashing rain and power outages as it made its way across the country. But when meteorologist Evelyn Cusack spoke to Sean O'Rourke, she was kind of annoyed by the amateurs out there making casual predictions.
Could I ask people to stop tweeting fake weather warnings and fake weather charts? There's some really crazy stuff out there, and it's very irresponsible. There's a whole lot of fake weather charts with red warnings and everything on it. I mean, the Metairn warnings are out. We've spent the last 2 days considering this very carefully. We've a full team of people here with the best high resolution model, and you know, it's very irresponsible. So I just want to say that, and everyone to take care and take the advice of the local authorities, the Gardaí and the Coast Guard. So that's it for me.
I wonder what kind of a mind it would take, all right, to put up those
Maybe some people think they're better at forecasting, you know, by looking out the window than Metair. And, you know, we run a 24/7 operation paid for by the citizens of Ireland. So, you know, I'm actually astounded.
Whew, well, fair enough. But as a nation, we do love a bit of weather. Because later on Liveline, Tom in Wexford phoned in to give us an update.
I wouldn't go out in it, I'll put it to you that way. It's not quite a roof rattler yet, but it is getting bad.
A roof rattler? Oh, I'd say Evelyn's throwing actual darts at the radio. But then we heard from Michael, who was at the foot of Mount Brandon, appropriately enough, and he was a man that had turned the most Irish of chit-chat topics into a proper hobby.
Do you think, has the worst gone past you, Michael?
I think it's going to come up again in the middle of the afternoon. We're going to get it increasing from about 4 o'clock onwards, but at the moment it's just violent gusts.
Okay, but have you your own weather station there as well? What machinery are you operating off?
Well, I run a little weather station that I have my own. It's only it's called a Davis weather station, Davis Vantage VU. Very good. It records wind speed, the pressure, barometric pressure, temperature inside, temperature outside, and direction, and precipitation, rain.
Well done. And that's a hobby.
Just a hobby.
Stay safe.
Liveline on Monday. On Wednesday, Ryan Tuberty spoke to Brian Stevenson, an American lawyer who has spent his career helping the poor, the incarcerated, and the condemned. Just Mercy is a new film based on his life, and he spoke to Ryan about the criminal justice system in the States and the country's racism.
I mean, we are in America still compromised by the smog created by our long history of racial inequality. We're a post-genocide society. Mm. What happened to Native people in America was a genocide. When Europeans came, millions died, and we haven't talked about that.
Yes.
We instead created this narrative that Native people are savages, and we use that rhetoric to justify that violence. And it was that indifference to racial bigotry that allowed us to tolerate 2.5 centuries of slavery. And the great evil of American slavery wasn't involuntary servitude. It was this idea, this narrative, this false myth that black people aren't the same as white people. Black people aren't as good as white people. And we never really confronted that. We passed the 13th Amendment, but we didn't talk about this ideology of white supremacy. And in that respect, you know, slavery didn't end. It evolved. And then we had 100 years of terrorism where black people were pulled out of their homes. They were lynched. They were beaten. They were drowned. They were tortured. And we don't even acknowledge that today. We had the civil rights era, and still that idea of racial difference persists. And so we haven't really taught this. We've opened a museum in Montgomery. We've opened a memorial. And the number one response we get from our visitors is, I didn't know. I didn't know about these things.
And Ryan asked his thoughts on the upcoming election in the U.S.
So it's my hope that people will get active. I think a lot of people who should have voted, didn't vote because they were just indifferent to both of the candidates in 2016. And what I'm urging everybody to recognize is that you have to vote. You don't get to only vote when you have the perfect candidate. I was taught that you have to make a choice between bad and worse, but you make that choice for bad because the survival of some people will turn on it. And so I'm urging people to vote. If they don't want to vote for themselves, vote for the immigrants, the undocumented whose lives are being imperiled. Vote for people whose health will not be secure without adequate care. Vote for the people who are being marginalized. Vote for people who are being mistreated. And if that happens, then I think we'll see change in America's leadership in 2020.
Lawyer Brian Stevenson with Ryan. On Sunday, Kilcoo GAA from County Down will go in search of her first AIB All-Ireland Club Football Championship title. But they are up against Galway's Cara Finn, who are chasing three successive All-Ireland titles. Morning Ireland's Gail Conway went to Kilcoo Village and spoke to some diehard supporters.
Unbelievable, I swear to God, it's unbelievable. It means everything to me, like it's just going to be a dream to come through.
It's so exciting because we're such a small group and just to win it, it would be so amazing.
Everybody would be buzzing, it would be great.
I didn't actually think we were even going to get past Ulster, but then it was unreal just to see them win against Ballyboden.
I'm so happy for them and I hope we can do it this Sunday.
It just feels so good and we have a great team and they just always work together, so I'm so excited to see them in Croke Park playing.
To be such a small club to get into an All-Ireland final is just class.
They've never got this far before and it'll just be a dream come true.
Yeah, we would be celebrating like forever and ever and ever if we won.
And best of luck, of course, to Cara Finn, but Kilcoo, oh, good Lord, the cuteness of that. We shall see. Football presenter and host of BBC Five Live on The One Show, Adrian Childs, was Michael Cummins' guest on The Leap of Faith. 13 years ago, Childs converted to Catholicism, and this is how he describes how the church drew him in.
Churches I'd been to before that were just kind of a bit bored. They didn't sort of speak to me, but you know, as soon as I went into a Catholic church for the first time, I just sort of felt at home there. You know, I couldn't really explain what it's about. I mean, I've said sort of mainly in jest. You know, it was because I looked around and I saw people a bit like me, which, i.e., you know, blokes I'd like to go out drinking with and women I quite fancied. But I didn't put it. I didn't put it like that to the priest. Obviously, I felt as if I was with sort of with people a bit like me.
So Charles went out and got himself a manual.
I bought myself a book called Catholicism for Dummies when I was sort of learning the sacraments and, you know, all the standing up and sitting down and, you know, the creed and the Gloria and all that. And, you know, I started to think, hang on, is this, I don't know, what am I doing here? I mean, I loved it all, but I think, is this, you know, my family started saying, are you mad? And then, you know, my friends were going, well, what are you up to?
He looked for guidance from a priest, Father Ben.
And I just started talking to him. And saying, you know, blah, 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 I'm looking at the sacraments and I had my big book there and whatnot. And he just sort of kindly stopped me. He said, oh, don't worry too much about that, the sacraments. He said, you know, 90% of that stuff is just superstition anyway. All right, okay. And then we just talked and talked and he said, look, you know, if you get, you have to do a bit of that to be let in, sort of, but, you know, it's just about being still and just the truth will come to you. He said, just 15 minutes every day, promise me now, you'll just be still for 15 minutes.
and Giles talked about the peace his faith had given him and explaining his position as a convert to Catholicism.
So when people say to me, you know, what do you do that for then? You've got your sort of back to the wall instantly, and they're saying, well, you know, what about this? What about that? You know, what about celibacy? You know, what about, what about the right to life? You know, all these aspects of Catholic doctrine. So you've somehow got to justify the whole lot. You know, so which I say, well, you know, look, this is above my pay grade. You know, go and speak to a priest or the Pope or something. But, you know, I'm not here to answer for it. And to me, religion is the one thing where it has to be not about, it's less about what you think than it's sort of what you feel. And so I work backwards from what I feel. And when I walk into an empty church, frankly, more than Mass, when I walk into an empty church, I sit there and then just everything sort of ebbs away from me. Mm. It gives me that feeling. So sometimes I've thought, well, if I'm going to regular Mass, sometimes it can feel like, well, this is a penance. This is, in a way, this is my sort of membership requirements, like doing a certain number of hours piloting a light aircraft, otherwise you get your license taken off you. That's what Mass can feel like. But I'm just sort of buying the time, buying that bit of peace, you know, in a church.
Adrian Childs on the Leap of Faith with Michael Cummin. This week saw over 100 tractors blocking the streets of Dublin for a protest organised by the Individual Farmers of Ireland. They want a better price for their beef to help survive. Philip Boucher Hayes was at the protest for Drive Time.
Well, you're telling a barefaced lie there, so.
Michael, with all the cameras here, you should be careful.
I am careful, you should be.
Michael, why don't you start your own co-op, process your own beef, and then it will work.
Individually, the protesters are open to explaining themselves, but as you just heard there, there is also a palpable sense of anger simmering just beneath the surface. The accents come in the most part from a belt across Longford, Roscommon, Cavan, Monaghan, Westmeath and Louth. As before, they say that they represent all kinds of farms, but they are in fact nearly all beef farmers. And just behind the anger that they have been left outflanked by industry giants and unsupported by government, there is a sadness that they know that they are at the end of the line.
How many kids do you have?
I have four.
And do any of them work on the farm?
No, none of them.
Would you want any of them to work on the farm?
I tell you, no, the margins aren't in it.
Is there a business there to hand on to a next generation, or are you going to end up selling up?
Not on the farm. And the farms would be worth a good bit of money. It's good land, prime land.
But when you're finished farming, that's it, you're going to sell it up?
I don't know what I'm going to do with it. I leave it to the boys, and the boys will sell it and probably buy themselves palaces or something else around the country. No doubt about that. No doubt about it. I just want to enjoy it for the time I'm in it. And I do enjoy it. I love it. I'm a suckler farmer with 50 cows.
But it's not a viable proposition. It's almost a hobby is what you're saying to me.
That's basically what it is for me. For me personally, it is a hobby. But to make a living out of it or educate my children out of it, it's not possible.
Does that sadden you?
It would. The fact that we grew from one cow grazed on the neighbour's land to maybe over 120 or 30 acres of land at this stage of my life.
All of that graft, all of that enterprise that went into it now comes to a full stop. Is that what you're saying?
Full stop, yeah.
Farmers talking to Philip Boucher Hayes for Drive Time. A Long Petal of the Sea is the latest novel from award-winning best-selling Chilean writer Isabel Allende. It begins during the Spanish Civil War and it follows the fortunes of a couple who are forced to leave Spain in 1939 and make a new life in Chile. Allende spoke to Sean Roxanne Arena, who asked her about the thread of migration running through the book and Allende's own life.
Was there something in the current moment, in the current set of crises around migration, that spurred you on to write the story right now?
I have written my last three novels, The Japanese Lover in the Midst of Winter and now A Long Petal of the Sea, deal with displacement, people who are uprooted, who have to leave their places of origin because of conflict, war, or other circumstances. Because this is now in the air. I have a foundation that works with migrants in the border of the United States with Mexico. So I know a lot of these stories. I myself have been a political refugee and an immigrant. So I know how it feels to leave everything behind, to lose everything, and to start again. So this is something very close to my heart. And because it's in the air and it's so so relevant today, I have been writing about it, not with the purpose of delivering a message or teaching people something. No, just telling the stories I know.
How does it feel, however, you know, I know you may not be trying to preach at people, but the feeling that here we are yet again, and it seems as if the mistakes of history are repeated. It's exactly the same treatment of people who are migrants, no matter where and no matter when. What is your feeling around that?
Well, this is not new. That has been the fate of displaced people always, historically. Every wave of immigrants that came to the United States was not well received. And they were at the bottom of the social scale until the second or third generation was part of the society and everybody forgot their origins. And so now, forgetting your own origins, you can be anti-immigrant without remembering that your own grandparents were immigrants. So this is nothing new. It's part of the human condition, unfortunately. And it will happen again.
Sean asked about the unusual relationship between Victor and Rosa, the couple at the centre of Allende's book. And this swerved the interview in a rather unexpected direction.
Victor and Rosa, they managed to live together for periods of time quite independently in some ways and even allow for other lovers. Do you think theirs is a good blueprint for a long-term relationship?
No, this is a strange relationship because usually people have some kind of passion. They fall passionately in love. And then for many years, they live some kind of relationship, sometimes open to other relationships, but most of the time, if that happens, it's in secret. And then at the end of their lives, it's a marriage of convenience because why are you going to divorce at 70? But in this case, it's the other way around. They marry for convenience. Then they have this long friendship that goes up and down. And then they fall madly in love at the end of their lives. And people have asked me, you think it's possible to fall in love like that at an old age? And of course it is. I married 6 months ago and I'm madly in love and I'm 77. So of course it's possible.
Oh, I think we definitely need to hear a little bit more about that. Well, Allende went on to say that she had ended her marriage of 28 years at the age of 72. And then, very unexpectedly, she'd found herself wooed. But it wasn't exactly love at first sight.
He had read a couple of my books. And it seems that something that I said on the radio, he did not agree at all. And so that was his first communication, was about not liking what I had said. I mean, this is a guy who heard me on the radio and started writing to me every morning and every evening for 5 months. And we never met in that time. We never even talked on the phone. And then when we finally met, because I went to New York for something, he invited me out for lunch. And then I asked him, what are your intentions? I have no time to waste.
A wonderful Isabel Allende putting schmacked on Cupid there with Sean Rocks on Arena. Back after this. Welcome back. Housing and homelessness dominated much of the news this week. On Tuesday afternoon, a man living in a tent along the Grand Canal in Dublin suffered life-changing injuries when a vehicle was used to remove his tent from the area. On Wednesday's drive time, Della Kilroy went to that spot and spoke to people living in tents along the canal. This is Darren and John.
Well, I was sleeping in doorways in the city centre and it can get rough at night with drinkers coming home from the pubs. Not only that, you're woken up by the guards every morning at 7:30.
I'd rather be in a tent than a hostel. I've been smoking since I'm 14. A lot of the hostels, if you go in, there's one there in the corner. If you go in there at 7 o'clock, you can't go back out and you cannot smoke till the next morning till you go out that door. And there's a lot of people with different problems that are in hostels that need help and they're not getting it.
And Della Kilroy spoke to another woman living in a tent at the canal.
For one woman, she's been homeless for around 3 years, but she's been moving around the canal for about 5 months, she told me, in different locations, staying with a friend in a two-person tent again because her tent has been moved. She told me that she used to see the man who she believes is currently in hospital because her tent is close by, sitting on a nearby bench quite often. She told me what she heard happened yesterday.
But it just shows you, like, because the corporation was up here yesterday with the waterways and we were talking to them and they said they checked, they got in and checked every tent. So if they got in, they would have seen that man. Like, this was at 11 o'clock yesterday morning. So if they did check it, they would have seen him. it's you hear one story and then another, so you sort of don't know what to believe. Like,
what brought you to the canal? Why are you living in the
tent? It's safer than some of the hostels. It's safer to be out here or in a doorway.
Do you pack up every day or?
No, we leave the tent there and just take on that sort of main stuff to us. With us, less hassle. Like, we've enough problems of our own without mixing up with other people and getting more problems, so we like it over here. Like,
there's a storm earlier this week, and it's very
by the tent. Yeah, it's all bare snap.
The tent is pretty much, it's half fallen down.
Yeah, so it's sort of like you get used to it, you know what I mean? We just sort of part of about and we go to the library, or we just sit in and have a cup of tea somewhere and just come back probably about 7 o'clock. Do you know what I mean? Bring a cup of tea, wait for the super and have something to eat and go to sleep and just go up and start all over again.
And have you got an eviction notice, or have they tried to move you?
Yes, yeah. They took quite a lot. We had a better tent than that and they took it yesterday with all their stuff in it. When we got here, they were actually pulling it off and wouldn't let us take anything out.
So you had to get a new or different tent?
Yeah, it was that one, but it wasn't like that. And last night, the breeze, whichever way it blew, snapped the bar in it. So we have to get a new one.
There's an election next month. Are you hopeful?
Hopefully something will be done now with the election coming up. If something isn't done, we'll be found dead out here because it's getting that cold. It's not summer, it's not warm. Like, it's freezing out. Like we had no blankets, no nothing last night. They took everything and we got that tent, and only for the super one feed their homeless come up and gave us blankets and stuff last night and a little torch and stuff so we could see. Like, do you know what I mean?
Drive time on Wednesday. The following day, homeless campaigner Father Peter McVerry spoke on Morning Ireland.
It's true that there are hostel places available, but what's not discussed is the quality of those hostel placements. Many people don't feel safe in those hostels. Some hostels are excellent. Let me first of all say that. They're excellent. People are very, very happy there. But there are many hostels where people are sharing a room with three or four or five or six other people. You don't know who you're sharing with. You can have people who are injecting heroin or smoking crack cocaine at 2 o'clock in the morning in front of you. You can have people with serious personality problems. I had a report just a few days ago of somebody who was sleeping in a top bunk, and the lad in the bottom bunk, who obviously had mental health issues, in the middle of the night got up and started stabbing the mattress on the top bunk with a knife where he was sleeping. Now, if you have that experience in a hostel, you're going to be very slow to go back to a hostel again. So why do we have these little tent encampments? And they're all over the place, actually. I think for two reasons. One, people feel safe. They're with other people that they know and they get on with. And they also have comradeship with the people that they're in the other tents. And that's what's missing in the hostels. One, they're not safe. Two, there's no comradeship. If you go into a hostel with 40 or 60 people, there's no comradeship there. You don't know who you're going to be in the hostel with that particular night. Mm. And so it's a lot of people just simply say, I'm not going into those hostels. I just don't feel safe. The biggest complaint I get from homeless people is they wake up in the morning and all the people who are sleeping in the room with them are gone, and so is all their belongings.
Father Peter McVerry, as heard on Thursday's Morning Ireland. On the Lyric feature, art critic Christine Leach explores how ideas of Ireland and Irish identity have been visually represented over 300 years. One painting up for discussion was a view of Cork City from about 1750 by the Cork artist John Butts. Michael Waldron spoke to Christine about what the painting tells us about Cork City at that time.
The painting is a panoramic view of the city. It's evening and the light is filtering across the city. So you have the rolling hills, the flat city centre, and I suppose dominating the skyline is Shandon Steeple. And then right in the heart of the city, you have this extraordinary urban fabric that I suppose is now gone in many ways.
You really get a sense of the city being, the middle of the city being on an island, like surrounded by water. It's quite Venetian looking.
Very much so. This could be Venice if you kind of zoomed in a little bit more. And many of today's city streets were waterways. So to the left-hand side, you have the large body of the north channel of the river flowing in between the buildings. And today, this is Patrick Street with its serpentine shape. It was a river. Equally, almost at the centre of the painting, you have another waterway that kind of pushes through into the buildings. Today, that would be Emmett Place. And the large Palladian-style red brick building on that quay is today's Crawford Art Gallery. It was then the Custom House of Cork.
So we're standing in the building that is right in the centre of this painting.
The window right next to this painting is in the picture, so you couldn't get much closer to the moment, if you will.
And it being a portrait of Cork painted by a Cork native, the city's place is central, not only to Ireland, but also to the world.
It is in close proximity to the south of Britain. It is on a major trading route, not only towards the United States, but also south to Portugal and Africa, and then, of course, to round into the Pacific or the Indian Oceans. So Cork is ideally located, a capacious harbour, a haven where you can shelter, but you can also stage naval interventions as well. With this sort of garrison element to it, you have safe trade, safe passage. Butt's view of Cork also tells us something about how upwardly mobile you could be in the city. And it was reputed at this time, or slightly later, that if you came to Cork, within 10 years you could make your fortune.
Ah, Cork City, not exactly known for its inferiority complex. That was Michael Waldron with Christine Leach on the lyric feature. Saoirse Ronan has been nominated for a Best Acting Oscar for her role in Little Women. And when Chris Wasser came into Sean Rocks and Arena, well, he wasn't holding back on the bitterness.
Really is a phenomenal achievement for Saoirse Ronan to be there with a fourth nomination, Chris.
Unbelievable. She is 25 years of age, which just makes me sick that she has four nominations in the space of 13 years.
I think she was very young when she got her first one for Atonement.
That's it. Barely a teenager when she received her first nomination for Atonement. She was then nominated later on for her leading role in Brooklyn and for another Greta Gerwig film a couple of years ago with Lady Bird.
Yeah, because this nomination is for Greta Gerwig's adaptation of Little Women.
That's it, yeah. And I think, you know, look, she is tremendous in Little Women. And I thought what Greta Gerwig did with Little Women, I see it more as a remix or an intriguing and inventive cover version of the original story. I thought what she did with it was brilliant. But Saoirse Ronan, she's so much more than just another cinematic version of Jo Marsh. I thought she was the quiet beating heart of that film. She was funny, she was spirited, charming. She really was the glue that held it all together. And I just think as well, Saoirse Ronan, she was a terrific performer when she was younger, but something has happened in the last 5 or 6 years in terms of both picking her roles and the presence and power that we're seeing on screen.
Not everybody can make the transition from child performer or young performer to adult.
That's it. God knows we've had so many talented young performers who have just made a dodgy transition or indeed forgotten how to act. But I think Saoirse Ronan is getting better with adulthood, and she's terrific.
Not even the hint of a misstep. Come on, the Saoirse. That was Arena on Monday night. The start of the week saw Ryan Tuberty channeling a certain friskiness, courtesy of a tortoise.
They call him Diego. Diego the tortoise had an unstoppable libido. And I just feel the idea of an unstoppable libido and a tortoise doesn't... Hey, everybody. Oh. You can fill in the next bit. Anyway, he was credited as a major reason for the survival of his fellow giant tortoises on Española, which is part of the Galapagos Islands. He was shipped over from San Diego Zoo as part of a breeding program. So obviously in the Galapagos, does anyone, a big call out on Twitter, anyone know of a tortoise who loves the other? Like really, really need it. Anyway, he started his campaign of promiscuity. When he did, there were just 12 females of his species alive on the island. And then all hell broke loose. Diego, the unstoppable tortoise, landed. And within days, if not weeks, he had so much sex that he helped boost the population to over 2,000. What was he doing?
Oh, I think we might have a fair idea. Moving on. On Thursday, Sean O'Rourke found himself in a state of prolonged shock and incredulity when he interviewed Rolf Doberly, who 7 years ago had given up. Deep breath, following the news. He's now written a book called Stop Reading the News, a manifesto for a happier, calmer and wiser life.
Have you lost all interest in what's going on in the world?
No,
No, that's a good question. I have a huge interest in the world, but I think the news format is the wrong format to deliver that knowledge of what's happening in the world. So longer formats work much better. You go deep, you understand the connections, you understand the generators of the events. But the news format with just the scandalous stuff from around the world, 99% is irrelevant to your life. That's the wrong format. So I'd like to cut this out of my life.
Now, I don't know if you heard it, but that was the sound of Sean O'Rourke's eyeballs rolling repeatedly back in his head.
Yes, but I mean, earlier this week on Monday morning, for instance, I happened to catch the start of the Today Show on Radio 4. They were talking about the uprising and the street protests against the government in Iran. There was an item about violence against students in India. And of course, there was talk as well about progress in Northern Ireland politically. Now, surely those are all interesting and important world events.
Absolutely. Super interesting stuff. The question is, how much time do you want to spend of your life surfing through interesting stuff? But then, you know, how much do you want to invest into things that you cannot control? So, for example, it's interesting to know what's happening in the Middle East, but there's absolutely nothing I could do for the Middle East. What we should do is we should decide what the types of knowledge are we want to accumulate and then go deep. And deep means long articles, means documentaries, means books, but it's not the news format. Wrong format.
Sean asks about elections. Surely to God, elections are a place where news matters.
Well, as it happens right now in this country, we've just embarked on a general election campaign. How could anybody possibly stay informed and even reach decisions about how to vote without following the news?
You know, the democracy, how it was built, was thought without having a news avalanche. So the guys who were thinking about building a democracy, the liberal democracy we have in the Western world, was built by thinkers like John Locke, Hume, and Montesquieu. They didn't rely on a news avalanche. They relied on people meeting and discussing these subjects and going deep in deep discussions. So democracy does not rely on world news. It relies on people discussing certain topics.
Well, it's quite possible that Sean was being scraped off the floor at that point, but he persisted.
Ralph, did you know that Notre Dame Cathedral burnt down last year?
I heard about that.
How did you find out?
I don't remember. Somebody told me.
How long after the event?
I don't know.
Is it something you
maybe
care about?
No, maybe because it's not in my circle of competence. So I care about what's in my circle of competence. I want to be, you know, every person has.
But this is one of the world's great cultural sites, as well as being an important cathedral in Roman Catholicism. Going back for centuries.
Absolutely. And it's horrible if these things burn down. But what can I do as a news consumer? Once you watch news, it's burnt down anyway. It's already done.
Sean, with tears in his eyes, finishes the interview thus.
I have to call a halt to this conversation. I really will end up out of a job if we let it go on for much longer. Listen, thank you so much indeed for talking to me.
Ralph DeBelly with Sean O'Rourke on Thursday. But rest assured, political anoraks, you're in news heaven for the next few weeks. So whether you're wearing out the shoe leather, canvassing, or simply observing as you weigh up where best to put your tick, put on your most comfortable shoes and enjoy democracy in action. That is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.